Okay, get ready to hear some things that are going to really amaze some of you. Certainly should fascinate even some more and maybe mind-boggle the whole raft of you. Clark McClelland, SCO, former space shuttle team scientist for many years at the Cape, is on with us this hour. Clark has just released for all of you a new chapter in his book. This is an extraordinary man with an extraordinary story, and I'd urge all of you just to click on his name. Go to his website. It's called Stargate Chronicles. There's a hyphen in there. Stargate-chronicles.com if you're not able to get to a computer now and you want to remember that. The name of his book is the same. It is a book that has many chapters that are not finished yet. He is working on them. Clark has been made to pay a terrible price, an original whistleblower, patriot hero in this country, a man who sees things as they really are, not as we all would like them to be, but the ugly truth, and the ugly truth is not a pretty sight. He's been on the program a number of times over the years. He is back this hour to talk to us about Chapter 13 in his book, which you can find at Rents.com, simply by, again, going to Clark's name, and you'll go there. Clark, are you with us?
I'm here, Jeff.
All right. I would say, how are you? But I know how are you. And Clark is not doing well. He has a number of physical issues. He is in great pain all the time. I don't want to belabor that point. But I don't know how he's still able to do his writing, editing, and thinking, dealing with pain like he has to. The government, of course, for his efforts to be a great American patriot, yanked all of his benefits, literally cast him away after how many years of service, Clark?
1958 to 1992.
That's all, huh? Jeez. And these goons, these ghouls in the federal government, or wherever they're from, literally stripped Clark bare and threw him out. This is beyond belief. Clark McClelland had the great honor and privilege of knowing many of the most brilliant scientists of the last century, i.e. German scientists who came over here on paperclip and did work literally building the American space program to the extent that it was able to launch the Apollo missions and so forth, and the influence of those brilliant scientists continues to this day. What Clark learned from the German scientists was far more than traditional rocketry and rocket science, and that's part of what we're going to talk about this hour. I want you to keep the expression D-I-E, second word, G-L-O-C-K-E, deglock, in mind as we continue our conversation. All right, Clark, go right ahead, please. Welcome back, and we've been fighting this. I've been trying to help in my own right make your situation a little more tolerable, but it's a tough road, and I really admire you for hanging in there.
Jeff, it's good to hear your voice again. I had a horrible day today, so excuse my voice because I'm in intense pain right now. I took something I thought would help level it out. It did to a degree, so that's why I'm on here. I was almost ready to call you and say let's reschedule it, but it's okay. Let's go on.
All right. Well, I thank you very much. I'd like to direct everyone to go to the center column of Rents.com and go right down below the Japanese and the radiation featured stories, and you'll find Clark's picture there, and you'll see the title, Clark McClelland, The Stargate Chronicles, and you'll see part one and part two. They're both in PDFs, lots of pictures, fascinating material. Clark, let's tell everyone, though, more than this, how they can help you as a truly heroic American who has been betrayed by his government to the core. What can people do to help, Clark? What's the easiest thing?
If they would finally wise up and realize our country is being destroyed. My family originated here in the Clark clan, 1620, with the Mayflower. So I love this country. I'll die if I have to trying to defend it. I've done that before. It won't hurt to do it again. Although, right now at 77 years, I can't do very much. I have nothing to live on, hardly. All I have is a small Social Security every month. And to be honestly frank, that's not enough to live on.
And no.
No, it's not. So, but this here chapter is it has to do with the Cape Kennedy-Kecksburg UFO connection.
Now, for those of you who don't know anything about Kecksburg, it's a very famous UFO landing or crash or controlled descent and gentle landing. And there are a number of people who saw it differently. This is a very interesting story. Clark McClellan has an entirely different spin on it than the traditional people who have studied the case and who think that they know it all. So, Clark, let's just take it from the top and please tell us the story. We're right with you.
Okay, I was there, Jeff. No one else, including my crewmate, who's died now. I'm the only one alive yet that was there personally to observe all this. We had two military officers there, an NSA agent, and they assigned a guard for me so that where I was going to photograph and write notes and take measurements and all. I went over to the craft as I saw it laying there in the woods.
Hold on, Clark. Let me ask if you would. Let's rewind just a little bit and come back on the story. Tell us about what people saw. They saw an object in the sky traveling essentially not in the path of a meteor or meteorite, but something that was traveling more horizontal to the ground and maneuvering and changing direction before it finally came down in the Pennsylvania woods where you saw it. Now, I want to know what you know about the pre-crash activity of the craft briefly, and then how you were alerted to it, and why Clark McClelland was flown to that site so quickly.
Okay.
First of all, tell us about the path of the craft and how it was observed as it came in over Canada and then over Pennsylvania.
We were tracking it at the Cape through the RCA Worldwide Tracking Network. That's a very extensive at that time.
Uh-huh.
I had several friends there, excuse me, that one called me, and he said, Clark, you can't believe what's going on. And I said, what's happening?
Uh-huh.
I was at Pad 19, the Gemini pad, preparing it for launchings there. We had already launched Gemini 7 into orbit, and it was waiting for Gemini 6.
Uh-huh.
6 failed earlier because the target docking assembly to be launched into orbit by an Atlas failed and fell to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So it had to be rescheduled. We had a hell of a time rescheduling all that. So we came up with a plan how to do it. We finally launched and had. We were in touch with Gemini 7. Borman and Lovell were aboard that. I think I'm right for that. I'm forgetting things now. It was the GATV Gemini Atlas target vehicle that failed, and Frank Borman was commander and James Lovell was a pilot. They were both flying their first mission for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He went and tried another time to launch. Now let me get back to something else here.
Okay.
I went over to the mission control room, which was not in Houston at that time. And Alan, being a friend of mine, was the CAPCON, capsule communicator there.
Okay.
I was standing there with him, not talking much to him, because
mm-hmm.
he
mm-hmm.
and I observed an Army general and somebody else looking directly at me, and I thought, my God, they're going to tell me, Clark, scram out of here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do that because I was talking with an astronaut. So anyway, CAPCON came up with a bogey at 10 o'clock high. It was reported by Borman. I said, what? You know, I heard that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, a bogey? Yeah, so Bean asked him if it was part of the second stage or so of the Titan Gemini rocket.
Right.
Came back. Okay, Lovell came back after that. Lovell, yes. He came back after that, James Lovell. He said, we have several actual sightings. Now, when astronauts comment to that degree and it's so important,
uh-huh.
that means it's a UFO or something other than that they can identify.
Right.
So I'm standing there, and I was really surprised to hear that. being with Chalk, too. And then finally it came over that the NASA and the Air Force actually did it, cut off all our communications for the S-band transponder system, and we could not hear again Gemini 7 crew board comments. So I looked at Alan and I said, I'll see you later. And he winked an eye at me, and then I went out. I went back to Pad 19 where we were preparing the 6A mission.
Okay, all right. So this object was visually seen and picked up on radar.
Yes, it was. The RCA finally picked it up, and they called me on the phone.
Uh-huh.
Phone system I had actually designed to be put on the launch pad, so I was proud of that. And
nice, yeah. We're going to go through the break, Brett. Go ahead, Clark.
Want to go to the break now?
No, we're going to go through it. You continue, please.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And, I'm sorry, I'm in bad shape.
It's okay. You're back on 19.
Okay, pad 19. I was there. I had a phone call from my friend at RCA, and a RCA electronics engineer.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Clark, you won't believe this, but we've got several objects that are heading just now into Canada. He said, these objects, there's several. He said, but one is very large. It can be controlled up, down, right, left, whatever. He said, it's a controllable spacecraft. We don't have one of them. And I said, yes, I know.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, we're going to track this. I'll keep you informed. So he said, also, I heard some commentary by a group that was informed of this in Washington, D.C., and it sounded like it was Ultra, Group Ultra in D.C. So that immediately made me wonder about MJ-12.
Sure.
So anyway, we were just talking here. He said he'd keep informed of whatever else is coming up. And then we hung up. I went back to pad. I was closing out my things to do. It was somewhere around 5 p.m., sorry. And then he called back and he said, Clark, that large object that was controllable was actually seemed to come over Michigan, Ohio, and down the side of western Pennsylvania where it curved.
Mm-hmm.
It was adjusted in orbit as it was re-entering, and it was falling just east of Pittsburgh. In a town called Texburg. And I said, where? He said, Texburg, PA. I said, my God, Pittsburgh's my hometown. So I got on the phone, and I called my friend Robert Schmidt, who told me that KQB, Mike Levine, was there at the time. He sent one of his reporters out to Texburg. The reporter came back and reported to Mike Levine that he was talking to a military officer there, and a military officer that told him, we have a UFO on the ground. After that was the last time we ever heard UFO. And then the government came out and stopped all information on this case and said there was nothing that came down in Texburg. Don't worry about it. Later, they changed that to, because I recommended it to the NSA, NASA, and the military officers, that they should at least mention it as having been a UFO. So they switched and did that. They took my advice. And after that, then I was talking. I went into Texburg after we flew up there, of course, in a Learjet twin engine.
So they hustled you right outside, put you on a Lear, and zoomed you up there to Pittsburgh, and then you were driven to Kecksburg.
That's right. A military sergeant, whoever he was, picked us up in a car there, took us over to Kecksburg for the airport there near Greensburg.
All right.
And it was a very short drive.
Okay.
Very shortly. But to add into this, we arrived there up to or a little less than 3 hours after this was reported to have crashed.
That's fast. All right.
Right. And then when I went to the, I'm sorry, I'm losing it a little.
You're doing fine. Okay. Now you're getting out of the car. You're at the site. What kind of activity do you see? Now it's nighttime.
I see a lot of military closing off streets, asking people to not go in there. Then I was taken to the firehouse, where I was introduced to the volunteer fire company that was theirs. It was the I'm trying to see these things here.
Again, if you go down the center column at rents.com, we're going to link these under Clark's name momentarily. You can find the two-part PDF of this story that is Chapter 13 in his book, The Stargate Chronicles. This is called the Cape Kennedy-Kecksburg UFO Connection. It's a fascinating story. Go ahead, Clark. You're there. You're at the firehouse.
The story of what happened there, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And I went through with it. Before I left from the Space Center, the German scientists recommended to NASA that I be the one they send up here.
Oh, really? Now, as I said earlier, Clark McClellan had the good fortune to meet these remarkable scientists, and they had obviously held him in very high regard and suggested he be the man to be flown up there to examine this UFO, which had crashed in the woods just outside of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. All right, go on.
And what was I saying before? Okay, we went to the volunteer fire company. His name's in all of my list here. I can't find it.
That's okay. It doesn't matter. You go on.
Introduced to the volunteer fire company's assistant fire chief and one other fireman.
Right.
I had my NASA hat on, and my teammate had his NASA hat on. We were introduced to two military officers. One was a one-star general. The other one, I think, was a high officer. He was a general and a bird colonel, okay?
All right.
Okay, and then we were introduced. Well, the NSA man came up and introduced himself. We have no names of any of the military or NSA officer. They would not allow us to have a name.
Okay.
But our hats were on, and we had NASA name badges on. NSA man, he talked to several of the witnesses that had seen it. They told me that they saw the object coming in and circle actually in the sky and make like an S-curve, and it was finally heading back down, and it crashed in the forest just not far from the fire cup.
Okay, now this is again December 9th, 1965, folks.
December 9th. And we were there. They landed in dark. Later, we would leave in dark, so we weren't in there during the daylight hours.
All right. Now, you're taken to the location of the crash, which is in some woods, and there is a picture of that's an artist drawing of the actual impact site. The craft came down almost horizontal to the ground, dug itself a furrow through the earth, and came to rest there. All right.
Didn't burrow deeply into the earth, not very deeply at all.
Right.
I looked at it. What I was told by the German scientists before I left was, Clark, look for these identifying marks. They said you may be looking at the D-Glock. The D-Glock was the project Germany was working on at the end of World War II. They were working on it in Poland, and then a general at
Okay.
Was one of the leading men there. But then I was told that my own director at the Kennedy Space Center was the director of the Glock program.
Oh, really?
My God, you know.
What was his name?
Dr. Kurt Debus.
All right.
We had other famous people involved in it, too. Can't remember all their names. They're in my notes here. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm hurting bad.
All right, you're doing fine.
We went to the so-called crash site. It wasn't really that. It's on some large trees and such and branches.
How was it lit up?
Pardon me?
How did the military light the scene up?
How did they?
Yeah, they had generators and lights off the trucks.
They had trucks, and they had, well, the trucks were in there, but they had a hard time getting in there because it's all forestry.
I understand.
So we had lighting, and to be honestly frank, I'm not sure how the hell they did that, but they had lighting in there.
Okay.
It was headlights, trucks, and cars, and whatever else.
Okay.
To begin with, and finally lighting did come in when the truck to take it out arrived.
All right.
Then,
now, you see the object down there, partially buried, but not buried too much. What? Now, you were escorted by an armed military man, I guess, in uniform, correct?
He had an M1 carbine on his shoulder, and he watched me so closely because he was told to do that. I was photographing it, every angle. It was about 6 to 7 feet diameter, maybe 10 to 12 feet long, okay?
All right.
It had a bulbous part of it at the base that had scribble written on it. I wrote down the scribble. I gave the notes when I came back to the Space Center to the NASA administrator, and I'll tell you about that later.
Okay. Now, if I can draw all of your attention to Clark's Part 1 PDF, go to page 10, and you'll see a photograph of what may be legitimate. It shows two military trucks and a lowboy trailer, and the object, which looks very much like an acorn, is up on the lowboy trailer. My instinct is that this is a real picture. I don't know how it was smuggled out, who released it, but it looks very accurate. And when you see it, Clark, do you see the same object on that trailer in the picture that you saw laying on the ground? Is that what it looked like?
Very much like that, yes, except that the bulbous portion on the bottom of it, my opinion, wasn't as bulbous, but maybe that's because it's been 47, almost 48 years since I was there.
And it also had dirt over it, too, so it's hard to tell.
Anything else. They just picked it up, put it on the back of this truck, covered it with a large tarpaulin, fixed it down, and... No, I did not see them do that.
Okay. Now, they took it and lifted it, put it on the truck after you left the area the next morning.
Well, yeah, that's what they did. I don't know what time they lifted it and put it on the truck. I have no idea.
All right. Now, let me go back to the scribbles or the drawings on the side of it. You were able to see about, 50% of this object, 60%, something like that?
Oh, the... all the theory that had the scribble written on it.
Yeah.
And it had no manner of any type of understanding to me of any language on Earth. But,
all right.
But I doubt seriously it was anything that was made off the Earth.
Okay. All right. Very good. Stand by, Clark. Rest up for a couple minutes. We'll come right back. It's an extraordinary story. Clark C. McClelland is our special guest tonight, and I would urge all of you to read the two parts. They're PDFs. And you'll get a full idea of this this story that Clark McClelland experienced. Back in a minute. Okay, and we're back. Let's get right back to our conversation, a very special conversation with our hero, Clark C. McClelland. Served this country for so many years with the space program, was thrown out literally on the street.
I was in the U.S. Navy, too. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All right, Clark, go ahead with the story. You saw the scribbles. You didn't recognize them as any kind of language you've seen before. Now, my question to you is, you were able to make drawings of the scribbles.
I am a good artist.
Okay.
I sketched them down exactly the way I was seeing, but I also photographed them with the moon camera that they gave me to use.
A Hasselblad?
Hasselblad.
Oh, okay.
So I was photographing them. I was making a sound recording of it.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing notes along with my teammate. And this guard just stayed by me all the time. Now, when I was looking at it, when I noticed he was... Excuse me, I nearly threw up. I'm sorry.
You take it easy. I want you folks to understand that this object is somewhere right now. We have it.
It's in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
It's at Wright-Patt. Okay, I figured it might be.
No, it was taken there for the Germans to back engineer it. But they didn't have to do much because General Heinz Kammler, who's reported to have died three times at the end of the war, did not die because I went to Dr. Divas's office in 1969, the year we launched for the moon.
Mm-hmm.
He had me called to his office. I went up there, and his secretary asked him, and he said, send Clark in. And then I walked in the door.
Mm-hmm.
There were two men with Dr. Divas. They all three stood up. The two men on the chairs outside his desk clicked their heels to me.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
All
and
right.
Later, I recognized them when some of the other German scientists showed me photos of who they are. They were Heinz Kammler, the general of the SS, who was working on the Glock project.
Mm-hmm.
And also Kennemeyer. Kennemeyer is a very famous officer for the German Air Force. So I met two very high authority officers of the Nazi German Army and Air Force.
All right.
And then Dr. Divas gave me an autographed picture at that time. It was written in gold.
Wow.
And I went out. I finally walked to the end. I said, I'll leave you alone now to be able to discuss what you're doing. They all three stood up again. And the two Germans clicked their heels. I clicked mine, but I couldn't because I had rubber heels. And I walked out the door, and his secretary said, I showed her the picture. She said, you should be very proud. He has only done that twice.
Wow.
Find something in gold. He said the other one was for Neil Armstrong.
Now, that's quite an honor.
I knew Neil, my friend. And he then, okay, and after that, then, to get back to the case, I was
okay.
On the side of the craft, and, of course, I'm only 5'10 at that time, so it was likely larger than me and that I am.
Okay.
Better.
Mm-hmm.
I had looked at the scribble. I couldn't make heads or tails of it. I photographed it probably about, I'd say about 60% of it. The other part was below the ground. I couldn't see it.
Okay.
And I etched them too to make sure. I made a few comments. Then I walked to the side of the craft. I did not put this in this report, so you will not read it. I knocked on it because Russia's been known to send cosmonauts into space and have them die up there or die on reentry and whatever.
Okay,
else.
You knocked on the craft in case there was someone inside. How interesting.
In case. But I didn't put that in this report. I wish I did, but I had forgotten about that.
Okay.
So 48 years of long time.
All right. Okay. Now, was the craft making any kind of noise or emitting smoke on the ground in any way?
No, but actually it was slightly warm yet because it had come through the atmosphere.
Okay. All right.
And although it was controlled, it still had to go through the upper atmosphere.
All right. Now, I'm going back to the picture in page 10 of part 1, and that picture looks awfully real to me, and Clark has indicated, if you just joined us lately, that that looks very much like the object he was close enough to knock on.
Yeah.
And photographed and drew pictures of the etchings on the side. Now, this is fascinating. You then, I guess, were taken back to the Cape. After doing
I want to say more about that truck.
Please.
I did see a truck arriving because it had no way of getting through the trees. They were probably going to have to knock down some trees to get in there, I would guess.
Okay.
There was a truck just like the one that shows in that picture.
All right.
But I don't know much more about that truck. The military then, I heard it coming in. It was loud. And my other teammate and the NSA person and the military officer said, we better leave here now. They're going to try to get in here and bring in probably more lighting and such to haul it out of here. And it was taken from there out of the area of Kecksburg and driven to Columbus, Ohio, to an airport there. After they had a night there, I guess, to take rest. But they traveled to Wright-Patterson and delivered it to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
All right. Obviously, there are many things stored at Wright-Patterson, probably underground, and this is just but one of them.
I have a good friend that worked there.
Ah.
Told me they had about three or four levels underground of laboratories that were storing ET bodies and crash craft and the things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Wright Pat's very important. And now the Obama administration is destroying the Obama, Republican, Democrat. It doesn't matter, really.
Makes no difference, Clark.
There's no difference between the two parties. We need a new government of, for, and by the people again.
Right.
Anyway, they had laboratories down there. They had crash craft from Roswell and everything else.
All right. We're going to continue, Brett. So thank you. Okay. Now, you went back with your pictures and your drawings.
Yes.
Tell me what happened at that point. Now, there was some talk that the prevailing best guess was that this was some kind of a Soviet craft that had come down under some kind of control and may have been something of German origin, because after the war, of course, all the brilliant German scientists either went to the East or the West, and they were the prize of the war.
Oh, Germany had Germans accept Russia as their home base, and then, of course, von Braun came here. Von Braun's one of his excellent associates went to Russia. The object that came down was the 3MV4 acorn-shaped aircraft. It was guided into a soft landing at Pittsburgh because it was able to be controlled.
Okay. You have a number for it, 3MV4.
3MV4, that's right.
This is an original German number from the war or something that was assigned to this object later on by us?
It was Russian.
Russian, okay.
It was being developed by the Russians and Germans, but I'll bet you bet the Germans were doing the most of the work.
Well, they did everything. They even invented the Kalashnikov AK-47. That was a German design.
Yeah, right. It's an excellent rifle.
Right. Okay.
They needed what they had in it to send astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Mike Collins, the moon, because we didn't have that much controllable capabilities of our spacecraft at that time. And when that was brought to Wright Patterson 65, the Germans, I know all the Germans that worked on it. I'm sorry.
Did the Germans, Clark, when you went back and talked to them, or did you talk to them, did they say, yes, die Glock? Did they recognize it right away? Did they make any other guesses? What did they say?
Well, I made a sketch of it, and I told them what it looked like writing on the bulbous area.
Yes.
And I told them the size and height of it, and they told me that's the die Glock Park. It was developed in Germany and also sent to Russia and sent to the USA by SS General Heinz Kammler. Now, here, how did he get to the USA? This is an excellent part of this story because General Patton was in Europe at that time.
Right.
And Kammler got in touch with Patton. They secretly talked. Kammler told Patton he had the Glock they were working on. He had the actual instrument. The entire thing. So Patton may have contacted more generals in the Pentagon. Who knows? I don't know nothing about that. And then he told He was either told or he created an alias for a Cambler, and he was sent with the vehicle to the United States on a ship with an assumed name. They arrived, they trucked that thing up very secretly and drove it to Wright Pat instantly. So they had it there working on it before they even realized they had this Kecksburg craft.
All right, now this Kecksburg is 22 years after the end of the war. Now,
right.
One would assume that the technology involved had advanced 22 years worth in Russia at the hands of the German scientists who invented it.
Those people in Russia were as excellent as von Braun and his crew here.
Okay, very good. Now, what was the mechanism by which the craft was propelled? Did it come back into the atmosphere after being launched, or was it flown and never really left the atmosphere by much and just came back down, unfortunately for the Russians, in Kecksburg?
Well, it's a possibility, but the fact is it was flown to be sent to Venus to have a soft landing there.
Who said that, Clark?
Germans I knew at the Space Center.
So this was supposed to be a launched Venus spacecraft that didn't make it into orbit and was somehow guided.
It made it into orbit. It was
okay.
In orbit, and an explosion occurred in the launch portion of the vehicle, went into orbit,
uh-huh.
Meaning, when I say launch, it had a launch platform for the deglock to launch from to Venus, okay?
All right. Okay.
There was an explosion. It blew apart the launch pad platform, everything else. Had no harm done to the Glock, and the particles and such that were seen and were told to be meteor falling, that it was nothing more than a meteor at Kecksburg by a NASA scientist who said it was that. I called him out on that, and I haven't heard from him ever again.
Okay, what was the primary description of the propulsion mechanism by which the Deglock was able to be flown and directed to a soft landing? Was it being controlled from the Soviet Union when it came down, or was it being independently controlled from within itself?
It was anti-gravitic.
All right.
It was anti-gravitic. It was also said to be a possible time machine by some Germans I talked with at the Space Center.
All right. So we're talking anti-gravity somehow. And the craft itself, again, when you look at this picture, and that's a reasonable representation, if that isn't an actual picture, it's very close to what Clark saw.
That's right.
So the Germans had developed anti-gravity craft during the war. The stories are true. We've done many programs on this over the years. Where the primary development occurred was apparently in Poland. In some of the cases, and the people who lived near the base where this ultra-secret work was going on would hear tremendous noises at night, and they were instructed by the German SS under no circumstances to open a window or look out, or they'd be shot. This
right.
was one of the stories.
There was a concentration camp close to where they were developing all this. They used a lot of the slaves in that concentration camp as people that would work on the craft. Several of the B-1s they were developing there, B-2s, the prisoners urinated on parts. And of course, that would seep into and cause corrosion for very important parts for guiding these rockets. And a lot of them fell short, blew up in the air, and everything else because of that.
Oh, interesting. Prisoner revenge. Well,
right. They took out the people they'd catch and they'd hang them.
Mm-hmm.
Right in front of the other prisoners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, that happened a lot. Anyway, Cambler came here, and they would have German parties, beer and sausage parties.
Sure.
And our German scientists would tell me all about that. They would speak only German there. And then Kennemeyer would come there and tell them only speak German there. Do not use English, etc. And,
mm-hmm.
Von Braun now was a good man. He had his family threatened, and Himmler threw him in jail with Grotrup. Grotrup was the other scientists that went to Russia. They spend about 2 weeks or so in jail together. And then finally, high officials, I forgot their names now, got Hitler to release them. Himmler was very PO'd about that, but he threatened to kill their families and everything because he thought comments they made about wanting to go to the moon and stars and all that was sabotaging the German effort to win the war.
So in other words, they were supposed to focus on the V-1s and V-2s and not talk about space travel and space flight.
Right, okay. They all knew they were losing the war, so...
Yeah, yeah.
And Brown and Grotrip all talked that way.
See, and one other thing, Clark. People think of these people in the German scientific community over there as evil Nazis, and you just made the point, and it's very important to understand that these people's lives were literally on the line.
Oh, they were absolutely 24/7.
That's right.
I spoke to former Nazi Luftwaffe fighter pilots before they died. They told me the same thing. They had seen these Foo Fighters flying over Europe. They didn't know what they were. They thought they were American. Our pilots, seeing them, thought they were German. And so they were unknown objects. They all had their lives in danger with Himmler. Himmler was a very, very, very cruel person.
All right, back to the Die Glock. The scribbling, as you call it, on the sides, really not decipherable. Why would such markings be put on an object like that, which was talked about as perhaps a craft bound for Venus? Whatever. Why put these kinds of markings on it? Why not something in Russian, or why nothing at all?
Oh, I agree with you. I cannot explain that. They were not Egyptian hieroglyphs, because I'm an amateur Egyptologist. They were not Egypt. They were not the hieroglyphs. There were no language I could recognize. Excuse me, I nearly threw up. I'm sorry.
That's all right, Clark. Let me ask you another question. You just rest for a moment here. Now, is it possible that this looked like a Die Glock, but wasn't a Die Glock? It was something that happened to be similar in configuration that might have been, because of the undecipherable writings on it, something from somewhere else.
I don't believe it had anything to do with an alien ET arrival or working on anything here.
All right.
That's just my opinion. There's always a possibility, Jeff, because of some of the strange things I've learned in 77 years. Anyway,
well, and so many things at Wright-Patterson were of ET origin.
Yeah, Roswell and the rest.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Glock that was in Kecksburg was taking the right path, and then many of the German scientists worked on it. Were friends of mine. They just recently, in the last 6, 7, 8 years, died. They sent me autographed pictures and thanks for my work and all that stuff. So anybody that wants to tell me that I'm wrong for befriending Germans is idiot. They fought. They were trying to kill my father in World War II, but I worked with them in space. The scientists I worked with were threatened, families and all. Now, what do you do if your families are threatened by Hitler and Himmler? You just have to go on working because von Braun loved his family.
Totally understandable. All right. Okay, what did you see and talk to many or any of these very gifted German scientists who went to Wright-Patterson to examine the Die Glock, or this craft, after they came back to the Cape area? Did you talk to them after they had seen it? And if so, what did they say?
They were very quiet about it with me, because everybody at the Space Center knew that I was an inquiring, investigative-type mind. And a lot of times NASA was following me, like when I had... Dr. Roberts and his wife, they were watching a mission of the shuttle go off, and I got so much from him telling me that the Aryans from space came and gave Hitler and the Germans secret evidence and war weapons to use. Let's face it, at the beginning, we didn't have anything like that, the Messerschmitts and the jet aircraft that they created. So they said the Aryan, Dr. Oberth told me, the Aryans helped the German nation here because the Germans are Aryans.
Okay, so the supposition is then that I think what Dr. Oberth, Hermann Oberth, was saying was that some of the ETs are Aryan in ancestry or somehow connected with them.
And I know the star they come from. The star is Aldebaran in the Hyades constellation. It's a large orangish star, very large. It has one or two planets around it. Now, if it has a planet and it's that large, it may have an advanced race.
Well, we know there are countless billions of Earth-like planets.
Right, I wanted to say more things, but I forgot to tell you what they were now. I'm just sick. Von Braun launched the explorers towards Aldebaran. And why would he launch them to Aldebaran if he didn't have some knowledge of it going towards the Aryan nation? Of course, they would never arrive there in time of his life or mine or yours. But he did that. And it I'm trying to think of what I want to end this with because I had a lot of wonderful times there. But NASA had NSA and CIA members as NASA people working alongside me and with other people there. So every time we would talk to Doctor, what's his name, honey? Oh, the other doctor. The doctor that I talked with, 69, flew in to do a talk there. They cut him off from me after he told me, Clark, we're at least 50 years ahead of what the knowledge is of where we've reached. It was Dr. Rich, Ben Rich.
Ben Rich is the man who directed the Skunk Works operation for Lockheed in the desert, developed the SR-71, the F-117, and he told you that they were 50 years ahead in technology.
Yes, can I ask the audience, please? Can I please? I need help, audience. I know a lot of you probably need it, too. I have a moon gold photo on my website. I sell it for $100 and the shipping cost. It's a piece of gold from the moon brought back from James Irwin, who brought it back to me. He was Apollo 15. I put a quarter inch square of that moon gold on it, and if you'd like to buy one, please contact me at my website, please, or whatever. Jeff, thank you for tonight.
Oh, Clark, I'm here for you, and we'll do this again anytime you feel better. We'll talk tomorrow or very soon, and thank you.
And thank you, audience, for listening. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good night, Jenny, too. Thank you.
Hi.
Oh, here. Hold on, Jenny. Here you go.
Jeff, you're a wonderful person, and you have helped Clark tremendously. He's still drinking that ozone-native water.
Good.
And he's finding some relief, but I think what he has is just so hard to rid the body of. And we've been under assault by chemtrails terribly.
Yeah.
The last 3 weeks, that's why he feels like he has an upset stomach and a running
nose. Work quick.
And right. I know other people across the country are getting chemtrails too.
Oh, yeah, that's a big problem.
Terrible.
Jenny, yeah, thank you for taking care of him and helping Clark. You get better here now.
I met six members of the MJ-12 at the place.
Six of them. All right.
Yes.
Okay.
Lloyd Berkner, Detlev Bronk, Jerome Hunsaker, Dr. Donald Menzel,
mm-hmm.
Trevor Bush, and Luis Alvarez. I met those six people at the base.
Wow. All right. We'll talk again, Clark.
And Nathan Kleining was an MJ member, too.
Understand. Okay. All right. And if you go to Clark's site, stargate-chronicles.com, scroll down just a little bit down there, and you'll see a framed picture of Apollo astronauts on the moon. And you'll see a little square quarter-inch piece of gold foil in the upper right hand of that frame. That was on the moon. It's part of the gold foil from Apollo 15. And Clark sells these. I'm proud to have one. And this man is truly going through a tough time. And I hope some of you will purchase these. They are a piece of gold foil that had gone and returned from the moon. Clark McClelland. We'll continue after this.